This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. This is the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of April 13th, 2026. In water news, the Colorado River is running dry, and the federal government has proposed big cuts to the amount of water that flows to Arizona. Those cuts will hit some parts of the valley harder and sooner than others. Alex Hager went to see how one town is adapting.
On the outer edges of the Phoenix metro, you'll find Cave Creek. It's a town of about 5,000 people, where saguaros dot the hills above quiet neighborhoods. When it comes to water, about 95% of this town's supply comes from one source. It's a baking hot spring day on the banks of the Central Arizona Project, where blue-green water travels slowly through a wide concrete canal. Here, three pumps are humming away, taking Colorado River water from the canal and sending it north to Cave Creek.
These three booster pumps are what's providing almost all the water for the town.
Sean Cruz-Weisner runs the utilities department in Cave Creek. Right now, that is not an easy job because federal water managers are proposing cuts to the amount that flows into this canal. And Cave Creek doesn't really pull water from anywhere else.
It is stressful, and the other agencies I've worked for in the valleys have had the luxury of that more diverse water portfolio. So us trying to figure this out, I hate to use the term, but we're the sort of the sharp end of the stick or the spear here. We're the first ones going to feel the impact is Cave Creek.
Adding to that anxiety, Cruz-Weisner says, the exact size of those cuts is not set in stone.
We don't have clarity, and that is stressful going into this. And part of the unknown is how bad is the cut going to be next year?
Those cuts could take away 20, 25, or even 59% of the town's water. So now there's a scramble to find more fast. Brad Hill says the options are limited.
That's the goal for Cave Creek, is it needs water in the canal because that's the only way we can get water to it.
Hill is a water consultant Cave Creek brought on to help search for more supply.
Any deal that we do or any solution, water supply solution, has to be water in the canal, or it doesn't work for Cave Creek.
Hill says over the years, the town has been taking some of its excess water and storing it underground. But due to a quirk of geology, it has to store that water far away, and it would be too complicated and too expensive to pipe it directly to Cave Creek. But Hill has a plan.
What it's called in the business is an exchange.
He says other cities will take some of Cave Creek's underground water and leave the same amount of canal water where Cave Creek can get it. Those other cities were pretty eager to offer their help. Max Wilson is with one of them, the city of Phoenix.
I think anything that undermines the confidence that the nation has in sustainable lives here in the valley would be negative for all of us who live here.
For bigger cities like Phoenix, Surprise, and Peoria, they're basically worried that people will hear about one little town in the Phoenix area running out of water and think that the whole valley is going dry. Maybe then they'll stop moving here and spending their money here.
Everybody, when they move to Arizona, the first question they get from their family is, are they going to run out of water? Well, we need to make sure that doesn't happen. We need to make sure that's not true.
City leaders say they got a taste of that phenomenon in 2023 when taps ran dry in the small community of Rio Verde Foothills.
Even if one small part of the Valley of the Sun experiences problems, you know, everyone is going to get stuck with that same label.
Catherine Sorensen is with the Kyle Center for Water Policy at Arizona State University. She says what happened in Rio Verde Foothills was an outlier. But that didn't matter to people outside of the state.
That could be bad news for our economy. So I think that there is a very sound reason for all of us to hold hands and help each other weather this storm.
This storm probably won't go away anytime soon. Climate change and decades of drought will likely keep things dry throughout the region, forcing cities that rely on the Colorado River to get creative. Even the ones that are less reliant on its water. But in Cave Creek, water consultant Brad Hill says the focus will soon turn beyond the exchanges that can carry them through the short term.
If that surface water goes away, you know, we have 5 to 8 years worth of alternatives, but we need a long-term solution by then.
Hill says all the cheap, easy water in the area has already been taken, and the next steps for Cave Creek and other cities in a pinch will be difficult and expensive. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Cave Creek.
In other news, Congress has spent months negotiating the future of funding for the Department of Homeland Security after Border Patrol and ICE agents killed two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis. Those shootings sparked a national conversation about body cameras for federal immigration agents and what the government owes the public after serious use of force incidents. Elisa Resnick reports.
It's been more than 2 months since Border Patrol agents shot and killed Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. Cell phone footage viewed around the country shows the 38-year-old ICU nurse being shoved to the ground and surrounded by agents before gunshots rang out.
Minnesota called and we answered! Yeah!
It was the second fatal shooting of a U.S. citizen by immigration agents this year. Those deaths and DHS's response to them sparked nationwide protests, including here in Arizona.
We are demanding justice for Keith Porter Jr., Renee Good, Alex Preddy, and all victims.
They also contributed to the partial government shutdown in February after Congress failed to agree on DHS reforms and greenlight funding.
I just want to know how many cameras right now do you have on your agents?
During a hearing that month, Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi asked Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Rodney Scott about body cameras.
When you say agents, Border Patrol agents, there's about 10,000.
10,000 out of how many?
Out of 20,000 Border Patrol agents.
Requiring body cameras for Border Patrol and ICE agents has become a central demand made by Democrats during the funding negotiations in Congress. But that effort isn't new.
They officially launched the program in 2021, but CBP had already been moving towards adopting body-worn cameras.
Dan Herman is a researcher at the Center for American Progress who served as a senior accountability advisor for CBP under President Biden. He says plans to equip Border Patrol agents with cameras began during the first Trump administration.
You know, it was not seen as a political program.
Herman says efforts to release body cam footage kicked off after Biden's 2022 executive order requiring cameras for all federal law enforcement and a new database of officer misconduct. By 2023, DHS said 7,000 Border Patrol agents had been equipped with cameras.
A portion of this incident was captured on an agent's body-worn camera.
Edited footage and descriptions of use of force incidents began appearing on CBP's website that spring.
The following video provides information regarding a U.S. Border Patrol agent involved shooting on March 14th.
The first video was of a smuggling incident south of Tucson where a Border Patrol agent fatally shot a man through his car window as he attempted to flee the scene.
That footage is being released today.
The webpage is still active today, but nothing's been added since last May. Herman says it's not clear what happened.
Is this neglect? Is this lack of staffing, right? You need people in the back end to do these things. Is this a deliberate effort to sort of torpedo it? We don't know, right? And I think that kind of requires Congress, you know, to kind of do its job and demand answers.
CBP and DHS did not respond to questions about whether the footage release program is still in effect. But during another February hearing, CBP's Rodney Scott told senators with the Homeland Security Committee that multiple agencies were still reviewing evidence from the Preddy shooting, including body camera footage.
I can't jump to a conclusion on either direction. I would ask America to do the same thing. But I am committed to transparency, to making sure all the information we have is made public when it's appropriate.
To date, none of the footage from that shooting has been released, and the agency didn't respond to questions about whether it would. Catherine Hawkins, with the watchdog group Project on Government Oversight, says the footage program wasn't perfect. Families with loved ones killed by immigration agents struggle to obtain the unedited footage, and agents' cameras weren't always turned on. Still,
you don't want to see reforms rolled back, and there's also a worry that beyond the body camera footage release being rolled back, that it might be a bit of a canary in the coal mine.
Hawkins says other Biden-era initiatives, like a requirement for use of force incidents to be investigated by an oversight body, are also now at risk.
You know, it's not enough to say, oh, well, they have to wear body cameras. You have to actually see the footage, or it doesn't really amount to much.
That question came up back in January when, just after the Minneapolis shootings, an alleged smuggler was shot and wounded by Border Patrol agents along a remote desert highway outside Tucson. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos told reporters his department was handling the investigation into Border Patrol's use of force. As for whether agents were wearing cameras...
We're looking at all of that right now. I don't know that. I know there's video. Where it came from, I don't know.
This month, a spokesperson with the sheriff's department didn't release details about their review of the incident, but said investigators had viewed the body camera video available. That footage, they said, was back in custody of the Border Patrol. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
Find both parts of the series at kjzz.org. And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting a community conversation on the future of affordable housing. Join industry leaders, innovators, and local voices to explore new ideas shaping housing in our region. The event is Thursday, April 30th. Learn more at riosalado.edu/futurehousing.
In politics news, Turning Point USA CEO Erica Kirk, the widow of the late conservative activist Charlie Kirk, is planning a visit to a Paradise Valley high school next week, Bridget Dowd reports.
In a letter to parents on Tuesday, Pinnacle High School principal Jeremy Richards said Kirk would be a guest speaker during a student club meeting on April 24th. He said Kirk would be sharing her personal journey and life experiences with Club America during the lunch period. The gathering is strictly for club members and their one invited guest and not open to the general student body. Richards said the school will have an increased security presence on campus during the meeting. He added that under the Federal Equal Access Act and a state statute, student groups have the right to invite speakers and engage in activities that align with their interests. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter once said there are four kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need caregivers. As Kathy Ritchie reports, there might be five: caregivers who help other caregivers.
That's why there's so many little words. Mm-hmm. So you can get something done.
Bud Addison is sitting at the kitchen table in his West Phoenix home.
We're in the wrong book.
Bud is flipping through a workbook filled with word searches. Bud has Alzheimer's disease. Next to him is Emily Jane Crawford, a pre-med student at Arizona State University. Crawford is part of a new collaboration between Hospice of the Valley and ASU called RISE, as in Respite and Student Engagement. It's a paid gig for Crawford at $20 an hour and a lifesaver for Mary Addison, Bud's wife of 30 years.
And it's very hard because you have a person that, you know, what your husband's supposed to be like, and he is deteriorating quite fast.
And Mary needs help. For Bud, Alzheimer's is more than just memory loss. It affects nearly every part of his life.
It's hard for me to get him to eat regular food. He loves ice cream, so he can go through 4 half-gallons of ice cream and 3 loaves of bread in a week. And he can't drive.
Evenings can be especially heartbreaking. Bud will tell Mary he wants to go back to his childhood home.
His mother's passed away, his father's passed away, and a brother's passed away. And he doesn't quite understand that. It's like, I want to go home. My mom's there. They're going to come and get me.
Mary wants to keep Bud here at home as long as possible, but she also needs a break.
I find myself sometimes getting, I want to say, I don't like you anymore. Because that's, you know, he just runs me into the ground sometimes.
Dr. Jillian Hamilton is a professor of practice at ASU and the medical director of Hospice of the Valley's Supportive Care for Dementia program.
She put it very well.
RISE is her brainchild.
I think you know the data that caregivers often die before the person living with dementia due to the incredible stress of that task.
And family and friends often fall away, leaving that caregiver mostly on their own. So a program like this one is filling a much-needed gap. Caregivers are getting respite, and students are getting real-life dementia experience. Noor Hassan is Hamilton's student and the RISE student coordinator. Her job is, in part, to play matchmaker.
Right now, I think we're at 31 official matches between families and students.
And like any good match, it's about chemistry, finding someone who connects with both the person living with dementia and their care partner. For Bud and Mary, that someone is Emily.
When I say Emily is coming, he's very happy about that. Like I said, he goes to the door and greets her, and they immediately start their activities, and he just loves that.
There are clear boundaries. Emily doesn't provide personal care like bathing or toileting, and the money part is handled directly between the student and the family, explains Hassan.
Our goal is just companionship and caregiver respite, giving them the chance to step away while their person has socialization.
At least until Emily graduates next spring, which Mary knows is inevitable.
Well, when Emily graduates, hopefully there's someone else that's going to follow in her steps. I know I'll never replace Emily as the person that Emily is.
Like any new program, its future may come down to the data, which Hassan is working on as part of her honors thesis.
I've taken an early peek at the results, and one of the questions I ask is, could you see yourself doing this in the future? And it's so dramatically yes from the students.
Which she says is really cool, because there aren't enough dementia providers in the state. Dr. Hamilton says there are 6 to 9 month waiting lists for neurologists who specialize in dementia, and there are only about 115 practicing geriatricians in the entire state.
There obviously aren't enough geriatricians, but we don't need that. We need to educate our primary care providers about how to diagnose and manage dementia. It's not that complicated, but everybody's afraid to do it.
So Hamilton is leading a separate grant to do that. And later this year, Hassan will defend her thesis and hopefully demonstrate that a program like this one is worth modeling elsewhere. For Mary Addison, though, the results are clear. A few hours of help, a familiar face at the door, and just enough time to catch her breath so she can keep showing up for Bud. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In business news, APS will no longer disconnect customers' power when temperatures exceed 95 degrees, following a settlement with the Attorney General's office, Catherine Davis-Young reports.
The settlement comes after the heat-related death of an 82-year-old APS customer whose power was cut because of unpaid bills. APS already pauses disconnections from June through mid-October for heat safety. But Attorney General Chris Mays notes climate change is prolonging Arizona's dangerous heat season, and this customer's death occurred in May. May says she wants other utilities in the state to also pause disconnections based on temperature, not date.
And if somebody dies on their watch with a date-based policy, we're coming after them, too.
As part of the settlement, APS also agreed to add to its notification process for past due bills and expand its financial assistance program for customers. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Fronteras News, local officials in Flagstaff say ICE is now leasing office space at an industrial building within city limits. From the Fronteras desk, Elisa Resnick reports.
Officials with the city and the Flagstaff Police Department say ICE has confirmed a lease agreement for two suites at an office complex in the city's west side. The officials say they're trying to get more information about the scope and nature of activities planned there, but have so far not received requests from ICE to use city property. Eva Putsova is with the immigrant advocacy group Keep Flagstaff Together.
And our current concern is that ICE will be detaining people there and that they will not care about the conditions in which they will be holding people in.
ICE didn't respond to questions about its plans for the site. Earlier this month, the Department of Homeland Security put out a call for vendors to provide office space in multiple U.S. cities, including 8 in Arizona. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And finally, in original productions. Excessive marijuana consumption can be a nuclear bomb to mental health. The show's co-host Sam Dingman has a deeper look.
The widespread availability of potent, legal marijuana is a relatively recent phenomenon. Many people have come to rely on it for help with managing stress, insomnia, chronic pain. Plenty of others use it purely for recreational purposes. And legal marijuana continues to provide a fire hose of tax revenue for the state, over $200 million a year since 2022. But some medical professionals and industry observers are starting to notice a troubling trend among heavy cannabis users: marijuana-induced psychosis. Firm statistics aren't yet available, but doctors are reporting upticks in people developing serious mental health conditions that seem to be associated with excessive marijuana consumption. And our next guest has encountered some of these situations directly. Josh Mozell is a lawyer who works in the mental health field. He started his career in behavioral health as a caseworker for people with serious mental illness. Currently, he represents both hospitals and families of mental illness patients. And lately, he's been hearing a lot of concerning cases of marijuana-induced psychosis. Mozell came by the studio to talk to the show's executive producer, Amy Silverman, and me more about this.
We're getting people that are, you know, 35, married, kids, job, normal life, and out of nowhere, they're very psychotic in an intense way that never happens before. So I'm getting all kinds of cases of this untraditional psychosis.
Can you tell us what traditional psychosis looks like in terms of when it presents and how it presents?
Yeah. So the traditional course is mid to late teens. You're in high school. You got your friends group. You're doing well. You're getting good grades. And all of a sudden, things start to change. You pull away from your friends group. Your grades start to diminish. You start to act bizarrely. You separate from your family. Typically, these things do not come up past, you know, your mid-20s.
But often aren't there indicators earlier that nobody picked up on or that were kind of buried?
There are outliers. But I think any time that there is an outlier, you have to start to look at other things because there's lots of things that cause psychosis. In my practice, again, I was like, these are unusual and super intense incidents of psychosis. Like a, you know, 36-year-old Marine, served for 8 years, mechanical engineer, doing super well, married. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he believes that he's being sexually assaulted every night. He then buys a ticket to go fight the Taliban. And so you look back and what is he doing? He's vaping. When people were growing up 30, 40 years ago, marijuana had 2 to 3% THC. Now you can vape at 80, 90% THC, and it is dangerous. It's kind of a nuclear bomb that went off in mental health when we allowed it to be so prevalent and then really no governance on the amount of THC that goes into these quote-unquote marijuana products.
When you started to see these cases coming in of people like you were just describing, the Marine, what made you think to ask about their marijuana usage?
I had worked in the mental health system, so I, you know, had dealt with hundreds and hundreds of people on my caseload that have the disorders. And part of working in the system is you understand their background. People would come in and it's so unusual. I mean, a few weeks ago, a 60-year-old woman, been married 28 years. She's a CEO. She's an executive, got kids. And all of a sudden, she goes from her mansion in Paradise Valley to living in the homeless shelter. That is so unusual. And so then you talk to the families, what's going on? Is there a medical condition? Did she travel out of the country and get some infection? Every time, every single time, it was this connection to dabbing or vaping of marijuana. And if you look online now, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, it's kind of hard to find the links. But now it's very discussed because it's happening so much.
Didn't you tell me there was a study out of Denmark?
Yeah, there's a study out of Denmark that was done in the summer of 2021. That showed if you smoke marijuana and you have that paranoid feeling, that's a low-level psychosis. And so what the study said is a third of people have that feeling. Of that cohort, if you use high-concentration THC, what they said is 47% of the people that use high-concentration THC are developing bipolar or schizophrenia. And part of it is that you get super delusional, that you believe that the FBI is following you everywhere and that the CIA is after you. And so you don't trust anybody, including your kids and your spouses. And so you don't want treatment.
Is it dangerous to give someone the antipsychotic medication if it's marijuana-induced psychosis?
When it comes to the marijuana-induced psychosis, that's kind of the treatment course. And again, if they can get in and get that treatment and bring down the psychosis, then it works well. And I wouldn't say that it's dangerous. And I would say it's probably the right thing to be doing. The danger, though, I feel like, is that you go in and you get a diagnosis of some psychotic disorder. And therefore, and lots of these people get pulled into an involuntary process that then forces them for a year to receive this treatment. That's where the danger lies. Because the medication brings you down. That's good. That's not dangerous. But should you be on it for 365 days? No. We need to do testing. We need to understand these things in between and pull somebody off of that medication if they don't need it.
What if you're still using the high concentrations of marijuana?
Oh, you got no chance. Every family I talk to, the first thing we have to do, because we can get the person pulled in, get treatment in a variety of ways, but they're locked up, right, in a hospital. And what I'm pleading with the family about is, do we have to do everything in our power to keep them away from these substances? And if we don't, nothing works. You know, we've had really good results getting the person in the hospital, bringing the psychosis down. They get back into life. They use a little bit and they're just as psychotic.
How common was, in the casework you've done on people who are in that cohort, like between 15 and 25, where these breaks start to present themselves, how common was THC use in those cases?
That group, I think there's lots of comorbidities. There's lots of people that are using substances to deal with their symptoms. Most of those that the families that I dealt with and when I was an SMI case manager, marijuana wasn't the drug that they were getting to you know, treat their symptoms. They're using other substances out on the street, other illicit substances, alcohol, lots of times meth.
How similar is like a THC-induced psychosis to psilocybin or LSD or something like that?
That trip is pretty contained within the 6 to 8 hours. And you come out of it and you're done. What I see with marijuana induced psychosis or THC-induced psychosis is an intensity that, like, going from 0 to 60, like going out and spending through. I talked about the woman who had been married for 30 years and kids. You know, she went out and spent $200,000 within a couple of days. People's entire lives are pulled apart.
I hear what you're saying, that if somebody does a psilocybin trip or ketamine or any of these other things, there's a very intense effect while the drug is in the system. But once it's out, generally speaking, it seems like the person sort of goes back to
right.
their default state. But in the cases you're talking about, presumably the psychosis is extending past the point where the body has metabolized the THC.
It absolutely is. And what I have found is that they're not coming down right afterwards. I mean, we send them to the hospital and they get held at a hospital for a month, but they can still be, you know, so clearly they're not using the substance. But a month later, 2 months later, even when they come out, they have these low-level psychotic symptoms. So there's something else going on. My point is there is so much risk in using these things, and nobody knows it. The number of people I know that are just vaping this stuff at 70, 80, 90% THC is wild everywhere you go, and nobody knows that there's this danger.
Josh Mozell is an attorney who represents hospitals and the families of people with mental illness.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation and Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.